Hello, Looking Up listeners. This is once again Josh Elstro, editor and audio producer for Looking Up. In the interest of keeping our staff safe and healthy, and to help reduce the spread of COVID-19, I'm still the only member of the Looking Up team coming into the studio as we continue to quarantine until further notice. To stay connected to our listeners during this time, we're revisiting some of our favorite guests and episodes in the Looking Up library, until we can return safely to producing the podcast in studio. We think it's a great way for new listeners to get into the show. So, whether revisiting or hearing it for the first time, we hope you enjoy Dean and Anna's July 2019 conversation with astronaut and actor Mike Messimino. Until we are able to return with brand new content, stay healthy, stay safe, and as Dean would say, keep looking up.
Hey, Anna, I know you're a huge Pluto fan, a Pluto planet fan, that is. Now, so I would imagine your outrage towards Pluto would be even magnified, knowing that it was not the first planet kicked out of the Planet Club.
I'm outraged.
I know. There was an object named Ceres that was found in 1801. Well, it was called a planet in 1801 when it was discovered. Okay. And then the astronomers had the nerve to kick it out of the Planet Club. Can you believe it?
No.
1850s, they said, you know, I don't know if Ceres is a planet. I don't think it is. Let's call it an asteroid. And the asteroid belt was born with about a couple dozen asteroids that used to be planets and then were kicked out. And so Ceres is not a planet.
Terrible constellation.
Yeah, look it up. It's small. It's about 600 miles in diameter. You know, it would cover the state of Ohio or so. It's very cute.
And it just got demoted.
Yeah, in 1850s. So 150 years ago, the astronomers did it. And then they did it to Pluto.
How dare they?
Well, so I'm glad you have the outrage for something 150 years ago. From the studios of Cincinnati Public Radio, I'm Dean Regas, and this is Looking Up.
Both from the Cincinnati Observatory. Dean's the astronomer, and I'm the quizmaster. On this episode, we're excited to welcome astronaut, author, and actor Mike Messimino.
So Ceres got bumped.
Yes, Ceres got Ceresed.
Ceres.
I mean,
I'm trying to say serious. Like seriously. Okay, yeah, got bumped.
Well, if you'd like, breakfast cereal, that's where the word cereal comes from, because Ceres was the goddess of the grains.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Okay.
But
I'm
anyway,
with you.
It got Plutoed.
It got. Okay, let's not get smug about it. Like, make it a word like anytime something gets like X'd off, it's like, oh, I got Plutoed. Sorry.
Uh-huh.
Sorry about it. So I guess that means we haven't done any planetary exploration to Ceres. It's not a planet. But we've done a lot of planet missions.
Yes. You phrased that correctly. We have not done a planetary mission to Ceres.
Because it's not a planet.
Because it's not a planet. But we did do a mission to Ceres. So
really?
The Dawn mission flew by the little asteroid Ceres and circled around it, took some really cool pictures, went by another asteroid called Vesta. And yeah, it was a pretty amazing mission, like going from one asteroid to another. And
I just imagine asteroids as being either on fire or hurtling towards Earth.
Hurtling is good. That's about right. But on fire, no. They're very cold places
because
they're pretty far from the sun, so they're not not inflamed or anything.
How
like that.
How close is it to the one that I saw in Armageddon?
That is that would be a meteor or meteor or asteroid.
So much to worry
a meteoroid.
About.
Okay. There's lots of different terms, but yeah, I guess that is an asteroid too. It depends on size.
Yeah.
And that one was big, so we saw an asteroid.
But they're not on fire.
No, that's when they come through the atmosphere. Then they're meteors, and then they look like shooting stars.
Yeah. And then
so out in space, they're very peaceful.
They're just like floating along. They're like giant islands.
Yeah, exactly.
So Ceres is one, and Vesta is one, and there was a planet mission. Not a planet mission. Calm down.
Right.
A mission. Yeah. That flew by them.
Yes.
It was like, what's up, guys?
Yeah, they circled them, actually. They orbited one and then orbited Vesta first, then orbited Ceres second, and got some pretty cool close-up pictures. Because from Earth, those asteroids just look like little dots. Like in any telescope, they look like little dots. So it was cool to see them up close.
What do they look like?
Rocky gray things. Okay, so maybe they're not that cool.
You're really an artist with words, Dean.
I'm not. Yeah,
you're painting a beautiful tapestry for us.
Gray rocks with craters upon more gray rocks. But Ceres did have these mysterious white spots on it. And as far as I know, they haven't completely solved it. They think it's like these salt deposits that may have something to do with water, may not have something to do with water, that Ceres might have water on it, which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Because we could live there then.
Still not a planet.
Still not a planet.
Sorry.
Fine. We've gone to other planets, though.
Yes. And so, I know you're such, so down on this.
I'm really annoyed. I don't like... You can't bring somebody into a club and then tell them they're not in the club anymore.
I know.
That's not nice.
I know. It is sad, isn't it?
Kids, if you're listening, be inclusive.
Exactly.
Don't be like astronomers.
We still love them. I mean, it's not like... That's one of the things people actually... They're like, what did you do to Pluto? Did you blow it up? Like, I heard you destroyed it. I was like, no, we didn't destroy it.
You're like, dial it down.
We just destroyed its confidence. That's
right.
All we did.
We just destroyed any validity it had as an outer space object.
But as planets go, I mean, we have visited all the planets, and we have sent spacecrafts to all of them. And, you know, we'll include Ceres and Vesta and Pluto. We've visited those places,
too. That's big of you.
But, I mean, the you know, if we're talking, like, big, important things in the solar system, you know, we got to go with the planets. And it is pretty cool. The missions that we've sent to these are awesome. Like, we visited Mercury with the spacecraft called Messenger that orbited around it for a number of years.
Mm-hmm.
And that was like in the 2010s. That was the early, like 2010, 2011. That was like our first global map of Mercury. I mean, that's like less than 10 years ago. We didn't know what half of Mercury looked like. And
it's
now,
not a global map. It's a mercurial map.
Mercurial map. Well, it's still the globe. Of,
is it a globe? Okay, fine.
Yeah. You know,
I was just trying to like, gotcha.
It is, that is mercurial of you. Very good.
I know, right? Mercurial of me.
And then we got like a whole map of the globe of Venus from the Magellan spacecraft that went there in the late 80s, early 90s.
I wonder why it was Magellan. Like, I can see, like, Messenger and Mercury go together.
Yes.
But, like,
Magellan yeah, I know. That was a stretch. It was something of exploring.
It should be, like, Venus and, like, Eros.
I know. Or Aphrodite or something like that. Yeah.
Like, so I'm like, I don't know.
They don't land on all of them, unfortunately.
Yeah, you're like...
that one was...
you're like, it's already happened, Anna. You can't, like, go back.
That's right. But, I mean, even Venus, you think, like, oh, Venus, we've known about Venus forever, but we didn't know what the surface looked like until 1989. Like, because it's covered in clouds, so you can't see
it. Is it gray with craters?
No, it's yellowish with craters.
You're like, you're going to love this.
You're going to love it. You love yellow? This is your place. Well, the atmosphere...
Not gray.
The atmosphere is so thick, you can barely even see the sun through the clouds. In fact, maybe you can't.
Really?
It could be so... because the clouds trap in the heat, and so it is incredibly hot planet. So 900 degrees.
So we're not living there. 900 degrees.
900 degrees.
That's what it feels like outside right now.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
Not, though.
Plus humidity.
Plus.
That's right. So it's rough.
All right.
And then Mars. Yeah. I mean, there's so many different missions, and you know, it's like we've only sent a few missions to some of the other planets, but Mars is the one that we look the most at. We've got orbiters there. We got rovers there.
Rovers, adorable.
We got Curiosity rover still rolling. We got the three or four orbiters still there. And so that one, we got that
covered.
We are
really into Mars.
We got Mars covered.
Like, Mars is like our main squeeze.
Yeah, every square foot of Mars,
planets are like side pieces,
has been mapped.
Okay.
And so we know what's going on there. But then that is, you know.
But why do we care so much about Mars? We can't live there. You said we can't live there. You told me this already.
Yes, we can. We can. Yes,
could we?
Yes,
yes,
we can. Yes, we can do it.
This is like a campaign starting.
That's right. With enough planning and it's tough, that's for sure. I mean, you got like minus 20 degree temperatures, you got radiation,
like
you got dust storms and all that stuff. But out of all
more
of
craters,
they got craters there too, but it's red craters there. So that's
I appreciate the color variance.
Yeah, they're not all gray.
Thanks, space.
But I mean, that's our best bet, really. I mean, out of all of them, it's only basically because all the other ones are so bad.
Is that we don't send rovers to the other ones? It's like, well, there's nothing to need to see here.
Yes. So rovers on Venus would melt into piles of goop. So that would be bad.
That seems like a waste of money.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, let's just send more rovers. Hey, that one
seems like
work.
A bad investment.
Let's send another one.
That's right. Let's. This first one melted. It was the weirdest thing.
Yeah, maybe the next one won't melt.
Right, it'll be fine.
No, but then the outer planets, we got Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, that there's no solid surface. Those are all gaseous planets. They're all made of hydrogen, helium gases, and so there's no surface. So you drop a rover there, it's just going to sink into the center. And they're like, hey, let's send another one, see if it sinks. So, yeah, it's going to sink.
That,
it's all going to
sink. Sounds like a I just imagine them skating along the rings of Saturn, but I know they're not really rings. Calm down.
That would be pretty cool.
It would be really cool. Yeah. Can you imagine like a rover, like sort of Mario Karting it around?
Yes. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Do you know what Mario Kart is?
I do.
A video game.
Yeah.
Okay.
I do a little, really cool. Little Tokyo Drift around the side.
Right.
That'd be pretty cool.
That's right.
Anyway, but
anyway,
before Saturn, Jupiter, we had a lot of visitors fly by Jupiter, but the main mission that really sent those great pictures, if you see on the internet, is from the Galileo spacecraft that circled around Jupiter in the 90s.
Yep.
And so that's where a lot of the good pictures are
of the spot.
And the red spot, yes. And the moons and all that stuff. And there's the Juno spacecraft that's there now. It is not a good photography mission. Like, they didn't put a good camera on it, which is always a bummer. Because, like, I always want the pretty
they
pictures.
They put, like, a flip phone
They have my flip phone from
like,
the 90s.
We're going to need to borrow your flip phone. That's right. You still have that razor.
I don't know why they didn't do...
Why would they not?
I don't know. It's like, we want to do science. We don't want to do flashy, cool pictures. It's like,
but people want to see the pictures.
I know. I want both.
Think about those pictures from Saturn that Cassini did. R.I.P. Cassini.
Yep. So, yep. Cassini's next. That's one we're talking about next. That
oh,
was
sorry,
the big
mission. I got excited.
The big mission around Saturn was the Cassini mission. And I know you love, I mean, that's what sells it is you got to have some pictures, you know, you got to show, you got to show off the rings, you got to show off the moons.
And they need to put a little personality with the different things. Like Cassini, it's like a sassy little, I really got invested in Cassini. It was doing all this great work for humanity.
Yep.
Taking these great pictures. And then they're like, we're actually just going to tank it into this.
We're going to crash it into Saturn. I know. It was sad. You know, you think like it's been out there for 13 years flying through space and
and some great pictures.
Unbelievable pictures.
Great work.
And then the final planets, Uranus and Neptune, had only one visitor.
I forget
visitor.
About them all the time.
I know, because they've only had one visitor, and that was the Voyager 2 spacecraft that flew past each one back in the 80s. So, I mean, this is
in
like,
the 80s?
That's the last time we've had a close-up pictures
that's
of
like
those.
10 years ago.
No, more than
right. Do you ever think about that? You think like 1995 was like 5 years ago. Not really.
Yeah.
Sorry, I digress.
Yeah, I think it was more than that, but I'll just do my math.
I meant, anyway.
Seems like.
Doesn't matter. So that in the 80s is a Voyager.
Yep, yep. And then we
did
got.
Did they say pictures?
Oh, yeah. We got some. Those are all the best pictures. And it was just when they flew by and saw those things.
Oh, aren't one of those kind of a pretty blue color?
Yes. Yeah, Neptune is the one that looks so blue and inviting. Looks like dark
but it's not
blue
inviting,
water,
is
but
it?
It's not. It's gases and methane.
And death.
Pretty much, yeah. But this is what's so exciting is that this is like, we're now in the 2010s, the 1990s. We're not 1990s anymore. Now in the 2010s, we know all the planets. Like, we know them all very well. Like, we're the first generation to know what the planets really are like, not just like little lights in the sky or gods and that kind of stuff.
Right.
And so that's what was pretty exciting to me.
That is exciting.
Even if they're gray rocks.
Even with craters.
Yeah. As Anna said earlier, we are super excited to welcome today's guest. He has been on our wish list for a long time. He's an astronaut who made 4 spacewalks during 2 missions to the Hubble Space Telescope. His book, Spaceman, An Astronaut's Unlikely Journey to Unlock the Secrets of the Universe, was a New York Times bestseller. And he played a version of himself on multiple episodes of the TV series The Big Bang Theory. Mike Massimino, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me, Dean and Anna.
So we just finished up celebrating the 50th anniversary of the moon landing. And, you know, we think that's just such an inspiring moment for a lot of folks. And I'm wondering how you got into being an astronaut and following those footsteps. And we have your book. It's called Spaceman, An Astronaut's Unlikely Journey to Unlock the Secrets of the Universe. Tell us more about your unlikely journey.
It began, I guess, when I was 6 years old and watched Neil Armstrong take those first steps on the moon on my television set in my home in Franklin Square, New York, where I grew up. I was really impressed with what they were doing, and I think everyone was. But for me, I felt like it was something different. I felt like this was really important. And the astronauts were my heroes. And I wanted to grow up to be like them. So that's where the seeds were planted 50 years ago, watching Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin on the moon. And then it was something I felt like I probably could never do as I got a little bit older. I just thought it was crazy to try to do something like that. I always had that interest, but never thought I could actually do it. And it wasn't until I got out of college that I started thinking about, well, you know, why not? The space program had changed a lot from the time when it was just military test pilots back in the 1960s, and the Apollo missions actually started to change. The astronaut office started to change a little bit more. Scientists and engineers, civilians were being picked. And then with the shuttle program in the 1980s, it really changed, where there were lots of scientists and engineers and medical doctors and people of all different kinds of backgrounds. So I thought that maybe this could happen. Didn't ever think that it actually would. Can't believe that it did work out. But I decided I'd give it a try and went to grad school and started applying and worked for NASA. And on my fourth try, I was selected.
Wow, that's amazing. So three tries and then it all came together.
Three rejections, yeah. Oh. Three rejections before I got picked.
Well, but now you've had such an interesting career and you just have done so many cool things. I'm really interested if you could tell us a little more about your role on the Big Bang Theory.
Yeah, sure. No, that was just pure fun. It was worthwhile as well. It was something NASA was excited about. The way that happened is that I was asked by someone in NASA headquarters, a guy named Bert Ulrich, who handles inquiries for NASA from movies and television projects and so on, where they want to work with NASA on something. And the Big Bang Theory was interested in the idea of working with NASA and having one of their characters go to space. And so they wanted to speak to an astronaut, and I was asked by NASA to speak to the writers of the show and the producers of the show. And I was out in L.A., just so happened to be in L.A. a few weeks after that request came in, and was able to swing by the writer's room and talk to them about what it was like to be in space and how they could maybe get one of their characters into space, but how that would be believable and authentic to the show and to the space program. And we became friends, and I helped them with the script, and went to see a screening, and then a taping of a show. And then about 6 months after I initially met them, I got an invite via email to see if I wanted to do a cameo on the show. And I said, sure. And ended up that one turned into a total of six cameos on the show and some great friendships that I still have. So it was really absolutely wonderful experience. I never could have planned out myself, but sometimes opportunities come up and you just say yes. And next thing you know, some wonderful's come of it.
From astronaut to actor and now working on the Science Channel's The Planets. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I've got a chance to do other TV programs with the Science Channel, The Planets, and The Planets and Beyond, National Geographic, a show called One Strange Rock. I've been a part of Smithsonian Channel. They're airing a show pretty much now for the Apollo missions coming up. It's called The Day We Landed on the Moon, so that's already aired. But it's been fun doing those things. I've always enjoyed talking about my experiences and how meaningful they were to me, and sharing the experience of space flight and pursuing a dream with people. I enjoy doing that. And I like doing that with my students. I'm a professor at Columbia. I also work at the Intrepid Museum here in New York, so I can speak to younger people at the museum and different audiences at the museum. But I also like sharing it via television on occasion, because you can reach a wider audience. And it's fun working on television projects. It's just generally fun. You work as a team and work with the director and writers and so on. And it's almost like a space mission, except you don't go to space. That's why it can be very interesting and very enjoyable.
That's what the podcast is like. It's just like going to, you know, you got a team of people. No, just kidding.
Yeah,
something like that.
Yeah.
Well, and with all this stuff,
hopefully it's safer.
That's right.
Usually, yeah.
Yeah, that depends.
Yeah.
So well, with all the, your, I mean, boy, you got so many things going on. Do you miss being an astronaut? What were the best and, I guess, the best and worst parts about being an astronaut and going into space?
I do miss it. I miss the camaraderie. Everybody there, whether it was, you know, the secretaries or schedulers or the folks who helped us get ready to do our training, who cleaned up the place. Whatever their job was, we all had a purpose. We all were contributing to something bigger than us, which was the space program. And in my case, shuttle missions to the Hubble Space Telescope. So it was great. I miss my friends, but I speak to them. I just spoke to my commander, Scott Altman, my two-time commander in space. I had a nice conversation with him yesterday and spoke to my other very good friend of mine, Drew Feustel, 2 days ago for a while, about an hour on the phone. So we stay in touch. I like staying in touch with my crewmates as much as I can. There came a point where I kind of had having enough is the right word, but I felt satisfied with what I had done at NASA and was looking for something else to do. And I was there for 18 years and really enjoyed my time there, but felt it was time to move on and try something else.
Well, and I'm sure there are many memorable experiences, and it's nice that you keep in touch with all the folks that you were in space with. Mm-hmm. Can you share with us kind of one of your more memorable experiences, whether it was working with Hubble or some other mission? Can you just share with us a little story from your travels?
Yeah, I think the most meaningful moments for me were getting a chance to view the planet from the spacewalks that I did on Hubble.
Oh, yeah.
And Hubble, our altitude at Hubble was a bit higher than space station. So from that altitude, 350 miles, we're able to see more of the curve of the planet. So it's you can see it as a gigantic ball in front of you. And when you're spacewalking, you're not looking through the window frame. So you can look anywhere you want. And it's just incredible. The view is just amazing. It's so beautiful. And I look at our planet, and I after looking at it from space, I believe we're living in an absolute paradise. I can't imagine any place being more beautiful than our planet, our home planet Earth.
Well, you get that perspective from being up above and seeing that, and what, you know, what it's like working on the Hubble telescope. I mean, you're out there floating free, basically, but you still have a job to do. It's how do you balance the two?
Yeah, you're floating. You're floating, but in order to do work, you need to be stable. So we have different ways that we can stabilize ourselves so that we can do our work. Sometimes you're on the end of the robot arm. Sometimes you're in a foot restraint. Sometimes you're using other methods of restraint because you want to be nice and steady. And that's we practice underwater in our spaces to do that. And that's where a lot of the training is, because it's a little bit tricky. It's like trying to change the oil in a car with boxing gloves and poor visibility and you're floating. It's hard, but you train and you learn how to use your tools and techniques and work together to get the job done. But we were basically repairmen and women who went up there to fix a telescope in fancy spaces. So it's like working like an auto mechanic with space tools and a spacesuit to repair and replace parts, and that's what we did. It's really enjoyable, very directed. We knew what our mission was. We know what we wanted to do. Each one of those spacewalks, we knew each move. We had practice, and we also practiced dealing with problems, because things don't go as planned, and you can't think of every problem, but you encounter problems in your training, and by practicing problem solving as a team, when something comes up that you never expected, you're able to engage it.
Well, you're still following along with everything NASA's doing. Is there stuff that's coming up that's really exciting for you or with NASA or you personally?
Yeah, no, I'm really excited about what NASA's up to. And they're building a big rocket ship called the Space Launch System. They're looking at sending people back to the moon, but to stay, or longer term, onto Mars. There's a commercialization effort too. The space station is really going strong. I was just at an event yesterday here in New York City where we had a downlink for some school kids. Some students here in New York City got a chance to speak to the astronauts on the space station. They're doing a great job up on the space station. And it's very exciting. They're doing great work, NASA is, and I think we'll be doing it for many decades. I think the other exciting thing that's happening is the commercialization in private enterprise and privatization of space travel. NASA is hoping to turn over the operations, or at least most of the operations, of the International Space Station over to private enterprise. That was an interesting announcement that was made a few months ago. And they're also trying to encourage and help some of these private companies like Virgin Galactic and Blue Origin and SpaceX, who are looking to send people into space through private enterprise, not through NASA. So it's all very exciting, and I think there's a lot to look forward to in the years to come. I think the opening up of space to the commercialization and to the opportunities to send more people there, I think that's just going to just become very, very popular and become, I don't want to use the word it's going to explode because that's a bad word for space, but I think it's going to become really popular in the that whole industry. The private space industry is going to become extremely successful very quickly in the next few years.
Well, Anna is ready to be the first woman on the moon. If there's anybody you can tell us that we can hook us up with, that would be great.
Oof. Yeah, the toughest thing about being an astronaut is getting sick.
Yeah.
So start trying now.
All right. We'll start the training today.
I think I got the wrong stuff for that mission.
The wrong stuff.
That's right.
So, well, Mike, thanks so much for talking with us today. It's been a lot of fun.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we get lots and lots of questions, some of which we can answer, some, you know, things go bad. But, you know, we have a question today that's from a kid from a recent event at the observatory, because it's very busy right now.
Well, now I hope I can answer this
question. Yeah, I know. I wanted to set you up and kind of throw you off your game.
If I don't, I don't know.
Oh, things go bad.
Right, yeah.
That intro covers that.
Thank you.
That possibility.
I appreciate it.
That's what Google's for. I'm just kidding. Don't Google.
I got it up right now.
I know you're like, my phone's ready. So this was from a Jupiter Night event that we had recently, and I think it's a perfect question for our topic today. So the question was, if Jupiter was bigger, would it be considered a star? Sub-question. Mm-hmm. / the more cruel version, is it just a failed star?
Oh, yeah. That's a pretty common thing that's out there. It's like Jupiter's made of gases. The sun's made of gases. Jupiter's made of hydrogen and helium, almost the same proportions as the sun. Mm-hmm. So if Jupiter was only a little bigger, just a smidgen bigger, if it tried a little harder, could it be a sun? And the answer is kind of. Like So you have to have a certain amount of mass.
Sort of.
And so you compare Jupiter to the sun. They're made of the same stuff, but Jupiter is like
same size?
1/1000th the size of mass of the sun. I mean, it's not even close.
Wow, really?
And so it's like Jupiter, if you try a little harder, you got to... you got to up your game by hundreds and hundreds of times. So it's not like Jupiter's almost a star, just a little smidge, like we add a little more pepper into it, it'll turn into a star or something like that. No, it's got a long way to go, but it is pretty cool to think of Jupiter that is so massive. I mean, you put all the planets into Jupiter.
Including Earth?
Bigger than all of them put together. And Jupiter has 79 moons circling around it. So it is like a mini solar system with its own little planets going around it.
What if it decides to break off? It's like, you know what? You're holding me back.
Yeah.
Solar system.
It could.
I got my own thing here.
There are such
little
planets.
Moons. Yeah. I mean, they're all my followers on Instagram. I'm going to do what I want.
That's right.
I'm breaking free.
Well, it's stuck
probably
right now,
okay.
But there are such planets that they call them rogue planets. They have no star that they go around. They just roam the Milky Way.
Planetary pirates.
Yeah, planetary pirates go from place to place, taking
what they want.
Exactly.
I'm into this, actually, yeah.
Yeah, they sip your drinks and don't leave it there. They don't wash the dishes.
That's right, they're like...
They just come and go, sleep on your couch, and then they're gone.
Like, bye. They don't fold a blanket.
No, thank you.
They do what they want.
Yeah. But no, they're rogue planets. They're starless planets that just go roam from place to place, because in our solar system we may have had more than 8, 9, 10,
13 planets in its original form.
Right.
And the planets may have been kicked out of the solar system, not like Pluto'd and Ceres'd. They like actually physically got kicked out of the planet.
Okay, Ceres'd is a bit of a stretch.
That's too much. Okay, I know. I thought I'd try it. You heard it here.
Yes.
Nobody wants to.
Spread it around, everybody. Right.
But so, yeah, our solar system could add a lot more planets back in the day. Mm-hmm. But yeah, Jupiter, not a failed star, is
that's
pushing
harsh.
It's pushing it. I would say it's just one big planet.
That's fair.
All right.
Well, that's it for this episode of Looking Up. Thanks to Mike Massimino for joining us. You'll find a link to Mike and his book Spaceman on our website, wvxu.org/lookingup.
It's hard to believe, but we have been doing Looking Up for just over 2 years now. I don't know, it seems like 2 decades.
Dean?
I mean, less than that. Seems like reasonable.
Yes, but less than
reasonable
that.
Amount of time. If you've missed any of our past episodes, they are archived for easy listening at wvxu.org/lookingup.
We love talking with guests like Mike Massimino. If there's someone from the astronomy community you'd like to hear on Looking Up, let us know. Our email is lookingup@wvxu.org.
You can subscribe to Looking Up wherever you listen to podcasts. And please give us a rating and comment on Apple Podcasts.
Theme song in addition... No, sorry. Our theme song in additional music is by Y. That's W-H-Y question mark from their album Moline, courtesy of Joyful Noise Recordings and Terror Bird Media.
Looking Up is a production of Cincinnati Public Radio. Kevin Reynolds is our producer. Josh Elstrow is our engineer, and Jim Nolan provides additional technical assistance.
Thanks so much for listening. I'm Anna Heeman.
And I'm Dean Regas. Keep looking up.